I'm Jewish.
I'm so Jewish.
I'm Jewish.
I'm Jewish.
A lot of people say, I'm Jewish, I'm proud of being Jewish. First thing I ask them is, why?
I'm Jewish. Make something of it.
Okay, we're back with Rabbi Reinman, and we continue our discussion of biblical criticism. One of the criticisms is that Jethro is referenced in the Torah by several different names.
Suppose his father had seven different names. It was Yeser, Yisro, Reuel, I don't remember all the rest of them. People in the ancient world had many different names. They did. That the names related to their different functions. Maybe kings. Kings had different names. You find the Pope. What's the Pope's name? His name is John Paul. But he's also Carol, right? Carol Wojtyła. That's his name. So is his name Carol, is his name John Paul? So he has a private name and he has an official name. So very much in the ancient world, with kings, you know, you could have King George, his real name is Tony. You know, so it's not, you know, people do have different names that serve them in different roles. And Yisro was a man of broad interests. He was, he had administrative positions, and he had all kinds of different things that he was involved in, and he had different names.
I ask him now about Onkelos. Who is Onkelos, and why is he such a famous convert?
Nero was a famous emperor of Rome. He was one of the, I think he was number five or something of the Roman emperors. He's very famous for fiddling on the roof while Rome burned. He was considered a maniac. He had a nephew, his name was Onkelos. Onkelos converted. He went to Israel and he converted. And he wrote a translation of the Torah into Aramaic, which appears alongside just about every Chumash. And, you know, there's an obligation every week to go over the Parsha. So the obligation is to do two times Mikra, two times the Parsha in Hebrew, and one time Targum, one time in Onkelos. Onkelos is considered to be a translation. Well, all translations are commentaries. So anytime you translate something, you are really, and if you know, I do learn Onkelos carefully, and there's a lot of interesting material there. It's not just a dictionary, and his work is considered to be divinely inspired. And he was a great, great convert. Many people in the Talmud era and sages of the Talmud were either converts themselves or descended from converts. We accept converts. There's a great commandment in the Torah to love the convert. There's a commandment to love, v'haftal riyacha kumbocha, love your fellow man as you love yourself. But there's, on top of that, there's an additional, the Rambam writes, that there is an additional commandment to love the convert because of the courageous act that he did. A man who left a comfortable life in a Gentile world and decided to join a persecuted people, such a person is definitely, you know, there's a great obligation on all Jews to have special love for such people.
Now we talk about the crux of the differences between the movements. How do we know that the Torah is divine?
The proof is that if something was supposedly seen by the entire people, by hundreds of thousands and maybe millions of people, and not only was it seen by them, but it was written down in a book which was distributed to all of them, and they were all commanded to write their own copies of the book. How do you perpetrate a lie in that type of a situation? How do you introduce a memory? I mean, that's something that everybody would know. If something happened to all the people, then every generation would know this, especially because the Torah requires that all the people do different things which will perpetuate the memory. he's supposed to have Pesach. He's supposed to, every year, he's supposed to sit down and tell it to the children. He's supposed to do, you know, do all kinds of things, Zecher Litzias Mitzrayim, which are to perpetuate the memory of the Exodus, to perpetuate the memory of Revelation. So here we have a book that says that the Torah was given to all the people and their patterns of life were reconfigured to perpetuate the memory of this thing that happened to all the people, and they all wrote it down and they put it in books, and every tribe got copies of the book, and every individual was required to write his own copy of the book, and every child that he has is required to write his own copy, and all of a sudden you're going to introduce something like this and nobody knows about it? People are going to say, wait a minute, you're telling us this Torah? The Torah says that everybody was there. How come I never heard about it? How come my grandfather never heard about it? How come my neighbors never heard about it? The Torah says that the books are all over. Where are the books? I've never seen this book. That's the proof. Such a claim is impossible to graft that onto a people, that people should believe it. You know, I mean, if you do that in the United States, it wouldn't work, right? You tell everybody that all of us, we all landed on Mars from Mars 200 years ago, and we all this and that. What? Really? We're all Martians? Nobody ever knew this thing? You know? What are you talking about? It's just impossible to perpetrate this type of a hoax on entire people.
Okay, so what about the people who say it doesn't matter if the facts of the Torah are true? It's the concepts that are true, the ethics, the morals.
Okay. So this is the idea of the non-Orthodox, that the Torah is, which that's why it's so antithetical to classical Judaism, because who cares if there's a covenant between God and the Jewish people? What really is important to us are the concepts and the ideas that the Torah presents. That is not the Judaism of our ancestors. So you're saying it doesn't matter if there was an Exodus. It doesn't matter if there was a Sinai revelation. There is no covenant. It's all a myth, and it's just the ideas. You're right. If the only value of Judaism is that you should be kind to your neighbors, and you should be good, and you should give charity, then it's true. Everything else is irrelevant. But if Judaism is the memory, the perpetuation of the memory of the historical covenant, that the Jews, by their life and by their practices and by the way they behave, bear witness to the entire world that God revealed himself at Mount Sinai and that God is present in this world. And that's something totally different. If you say that it didn't happen, then there is no Judaism. Now, these people, you know, now, some of these people, you know, raise issues. Which say that they say it proves that the Bible is not historical. One of the things that's very common, I think Wolpe is one, you know, raised this issue, is that that there are anachronisms in the Torah, that they Abraham had camels, and he says that archaeologically they've proven that camels were not domesticated until hundreds and hundreds of years later. So it's an anachronism. Obviously, it was written later when they had camels, so they put Abraham on a camel. But there were no camels, so therefore the Bible is not true. And other things like this. But if you do look at the archaeology, at the archaeology works, there are dozens of examples of camels, domesticated camels, not only in Abraham's times, which was, let's say, the 17th century BC, but all the way back to the 25th century BC. They have reliefs in Egypt. They have inscriptions and medallions from Assyria, from different places, many, many of them, which show camels being used as beasts of burden, people riding on camels. They have inscriptions of feed that has to be prepared to feed the camels. So all this is, maybe somebody said this a long time ago and the people still carry this, but archaeology has proven that there were camels. So many of these things are because of the lack of information. Most of the archaeological data is still underground. And the great, you know, Albright said that the archaeology tends to support the historicity of the Bible. And as time goes on, and more, unfortunately, I was reading recently that the archaeological community, because of political influences, is not doing too much digging for biblical archaeology. They're doing other kinds of digs, because biblical archaeology is a very hot topic. Because if you discover that the Bible is true, then that's crisis, because that means that you have to change your life. If the Bible was written, you know, 3,000 years ago, when it claims to have been written, then it's all true, because it was written to the people that it happened to. And if it's true, then you have to obey. So this is a very big problem. So right now, the information is incomplete, and this one interprets it this way, and this one interprets it that way, and you could be a radical, and you could say that there never was an Israel, and there never was a David, even though they discovered David's name on an inscription in Tel Dan in 1993. So now, all of a sudden, everybody's got to admit, just except for the most extreme radicals, just about everybody agrees that there was a David. But until 1993, many people said there was no David. David's a mythical figure. David is the Jewish King Arthur. But now they found the inscription. Okay, never mind. David is not the Jewish King Arthur. There was a David, but he was an insignificant little tribal chieftain. So this is all these things are they're just politically driven. The books that are written by people like Thompson, who just denies everything. He says the Torah was written in the 2nd century B.C. He says there was no ancient Israel, no kingdoms, no exile to Babylon, nothing. He denies everything. This book is a hot seller in the West Bank of you know, in the Palestinian territories. So what goes on in the archaeological community is really not very scientific and not very objective. But all these people, there's anachronisms. The Bible tends to be supported by archaeology, especially as time goes on.
We now talk about Israel, and I ask him if he's pro-Israel. How does he feel about Israel?
Israel? I love Israel. What do you mean, what am I feeling about Israel? About the government? About the state? The state of Israel was founded by people who were trying to create a substitute for Torah. They were trying to, you know, Jewish identity for all the years was connected to Torah. If you kept the Torah, if you embraced it, you lived by the Torah, you were Jewish. If you didn't, then where did your Jewish identity come from? So for a while it came from literature and theater and stuff like that. But that didn't have the staying power. The idea of Zionism, besides, you know, finding a haven for Jewish people, was to create a nationalism which would replace the Torah as the anchor of Jewish identity. Most of the Zionists were very much opposed to Torah. They didn't want it. In Israeli schools, non-religious schools, you would think that when they're learning the history, they would learn about Jewish history. That's where they are. When you open up a French history book, what's the first words in most French history books? Our ancestors, the Gauls. The Gauls were barbarian Celtic people who lived in France, and they were conquered by the Romans, who established became a Roman colony, and then they were invaded by Germanic tribes. But the basic France is descended from the Gauls. So whatever else went on in the world, they start with our ancestors, the Gauls. So you would think that in Israel, when you're starting to study about the world, that we would start with our ancestors, the Jews. But it's not so. When you read a history book in Israel, the Jews are not mentioned. You start with the Greeks and the Romans or whatever. The Jews are not mentioned until Alexander invades the Middle East. That is where the Jews appear in the history books in Israel. Now that to me is incomprehensible. But it's all part of a certain mindset that we should be Western people, we should be a secular Western people, we should find our Jewish identity from the land and from being a nation like other nations. And that is not the Jewish way. But at the same time, they did create Israel, and Israel is a place where millions of Jews live, and it's a holy, holy place. And it's a place where every pebble in the road is full of memories. And it's a place which is the greatest center of Torah learning in the world. And even the non-Orthodox part of Israel is slowly, slowly coming around. There are many, many non-Orthodox families send their children to religious schools to get some kind of a grounding in Torah. And there's a great tshuva movement in Israel. Hopefully things will go well. But, it doesn't interfere with my love for the land. And I would certainly prefer much more that the government should be a pro-Torah government rather than anti-Torah government.
Should it be mandatory? Should there be laws about...
No, I don't think that people should be forced into observance. I don't think so. I think people should be taught, they should learn, they should grow, and they should do whatever they can. And you can't force somebody what meaning will it have? I don't think that we should have a theocracy at this time. Although at one time Israel was a theocracy, I don't think we should have it at this time. I don't think we have the wherewithal to have a good, decent, functioning theocracy that would not be, distorted. I think we should do it not through the government. We should teach people, we should draw people close to Torah, and that way that would lead them to observance. I don't think people should be coerced into observance.
Life cycle events, marriage, burial, it's all run by Orthodox rabbis. So if somebody, there's a big issue now with the Russians that aren't Jewish, they can't get married, so they have to go somewhere else. That's kind of a theocracy thing, isn't it? Where you can't even get a civil wedding. If you want to just be married by a judge, why can't Israel adopt that? And what's your opinion on that?
If they wanted to.
Who? What?
If the Israelis wanted to, they can make Israel into a secular state. Israel is a Jewish state. If you could make it into a secular state. But if you made it into a secular state, then you cannot say that I'm only going to allow Jewish immigration and not Arab immigration. You can't do that. So you can't have it both ways. What is Israel? Is it a secular, democratic Western state? Then it's not Jewish. And what's the difference between Jews and Arabs? How can you keep Arabs out and let Jews in? You can't do that. So the only justification is that we're a Jewish state. So if we're a Jewish state, all state functions should be done according to Jewish law and Jewish tradition. I don't think that the government offices should be open on Shabbos. I think people, if they want to drive on Shabbos, it's unfortunate, but you shouldn't get arrested for that. You should get a ticket for that. But I think the government should be, unless the essential services, but I think the government should be closed on Shabbos. I think El Al should not fly on Shabbos. I think that the army should be served only kosher food. That would make it a Jewish state. But if Shabbos is disregarded and kosher is disregarded and Jewish marriage is disregarded, then what makes it Jewish? Just because you have Magen David on your flag? And I think they appreciate that. I think that, it's a problem with the Russians. I don't really understand the problems with the Russians so much, because there's nothing in Jewish law that says that two non-Jews can get married. So if you have two Russians and they're both non-Jewish, I don't know why they can't get married. I think it's only when they want to marry Jews that there's a problem, because intermarriage is not valid. It's not only that it's forbidden, it's not valid. It's not recognized as a marriage. if a Jew marries a non-Jew, Jewish law does not recognize them as being married. They do not need to get divorced.
I now ask him about the Reform view on some of these issues, because he wrote a book with Rabbi Emil Hirsch that discussed the differences between Orthodox and Reform.
One of the things in the book that I wrote together with Ami Hirsch, different people have told me, that one of the great accomplishments of the book was that it forced him to articulate the Reform ideology, and it stands as self-contradictory.
I wonder what he would say to people who feel culturally Jewish. You know, I feel culturally Jewish, but the commandments are not for me.
What does culturally Jewish mean? It means that, people, all people need a culture. You know, you can't just be, live for food and just to survive, to live. You have to have some culture, something that interests you, something, a way of life. All people need that. But I think that all, most Jews in America are very much plugged into the American culture, especially people in the non-Orthodox world. They go to the theater, they go to the opera, and they go to all the film festivals and foreign films, and they're into the music and into the whatever, all the literature, and they're very much involved in the American culture. So what Jewish culture, they don't really need that for the requirement of people for culture. They don't really need the Jewish culture. So what does Jewish culture mean to them? They like to listen to klezmer, and they like to eat bagels and lox, and they like to, yeah, I don't think that this is what underpins the Jewish identity. I don't think it's substantial enough, and I don't think they need it. You know, if they grew up in the shtetl, where they had nothing to do with Polish culture and nothing to do with Russian culture, and everything was the Yiddish culture in the shtetl, even if it was non-practicing. They had the Shalom Aleichem and the Yiddish theater and the Yiddish songs, and even so I can understand that that's their identity. That culture is their identity. But you cannot say that American Jews have that type of relationship to Jewish culture, because they have a tremendous personal identity from the American culture, like any other American. So this is just an excuse. It's not really what underpins their Jewish identity. Is what I spoke about yesterday, is that they do some level of their consciousness or their subconsciousness do have a connection to the memory of Sinai. They do. But it's deep, and they don't even want to bring it up. They want to leave it down deep, because if they bring it up, it will obligate them to do certain things, and it will interfere with their lifestyle. So they don't want to bring it up, but it's there. And by being there, it informs their lives. It motivates them to express themselves and to say, I'm Jewish, and to be proud of it, and to support Israel, and to find other ways to express their Jewish identity. But there is a real connection with the covenant, because it was just cultural. Like, what's in it? Look at the Yiddishists, you know, they had cultural, the workman circle and these people, that was cultural Judaism, and it's nothing, it's gone. That was just a holdover from the shtetl. It was transplanted to America, in Israel, in the shtetl, in the isolated shtetl of the Ukraine and of Poland. It was very powerful. That was the life of the non-practicing Jews, the people that did not keep the Torah. Their life was that culture. And they brought it to America, and they wanted to keep being Jewish in that way, but they couldn't, because they had no need for it. They had the other culture, just like any other American. And it's all gone. The people that today still feel a strong Jewish identity, it's ideological. It's deep. It's deep.
Something that connects all converts is the act of choosing their own Hebrew name. So I wondered why he thinks it's important to have a Hebrew name.
Why a Hebrew name is critical? First of all, I don't think it is that critical. I think that a name is a name, and if your name is not Hebrew, then it's still your name. It's not gonna keep you out of heaven. But at the same time, you know, a person should seek to be identified very much with the Jewish people. He should seek to have a holy name. A person, there's a practice in Judaism to name people after, the Ashkenaz community at least, you name after ancestors. And there, among some people, there is a tradition that you name after holy people, because there is a Kabbalistic belief that the soul of a person is connected to the soul of the person after whom you named. So therefore, the name really, though if your name is Brian, it doesn't really connect your soul with anybody, but if your name is Moshe, or if your name is Abraham, then it does. So that really is an important thing. And that's on a mystical level. But even on a practical level, you want people to have pride in being Jewish. You know, Scott is very nice, but it doesn't come to having a name like, you know, Ephraim or something, which is very distinctly Jewish. Even though today Scott is quite distinctly Jewish. Scott and Jordan and what else? Jennifer? What else? It says in the Midrash that one of the reasons, one of the merits by which the Jewish people were taken out of Egypt was that they didn't take on Egyptian names, that they kept their identity, that they kept their Jewish names. So it really is a historical, you know, cultural importance to having a Jewish name. But I can't say that there's a very strong halachic, you know, it's a reason to have a Jewish name. But you can pick a Jewish name if you don't have one. So you could, you know, you say, this is my name, and it becomes your name through use. Well, just because they announce it in the shul, but if it's never used, then that's not really, it doesn't take. But through use, it becomes your name.
I now ask him about some of the customs that are particularly Jewish, such as payas, the ear locks that you see on some Jews.
It's a tradition in my family. That's what I do. I wouldn't look down on anybody if he doesn't have long payas. Mine are rolled up and they would go down to here. And it's, you know, so what? This is the way my ancestors did it. There's also Kabbalistic. You know, I'm not so into these Kabbalistic things, but you know, certain traditions do have Kabbalistic origins. That it's preferable not to cut your beard and not to cut your payas. So my payas, I never cut them. I just let them grow and I roll them up. I don't think it's a major thing.
I now ask him about the wardrobe, the typical wardrobe, the white shirt, black pants, black jacket. Why?
Let me tell you something. My grandfather, my father's father, was a rabbi in a city in Poland, Narol. He was the 18th generation rabbi in the city of Narol. So that's where I come from. I come from a long line of Polish rabbis in Galicia, Poland. And that's who I identify with. These are, you know, if I have to identify with anyone, I identify with Polish rabbis. Not Hasidic rabbis, rabbis. You know, people, scholars. And I dress this way more to identify with them, because this is the way they dressed. They dress like this for generations, many, many generations. So identify, these are the people that if I would be Lithuanian, then I would look different. I would wear, a Prince Albert, a different kind of long coat, and I would maybe, it would look different, because I would identify with Lithuanian rabbis. So it's all a question of you know, people do dress to as a means of identification. You know, in the popular culture, people wear, you know, a certain type of clothing, baggy pants, backwards caps, and all these things, because they want to identify with people that are hip and, you know, hip trendy and, you know, with it. Every, you know, person dresses to make a statement. And my statement is that I am a descendant of these rabbis, and that is a tremendous thing for me, and I want my life to be a continuation of their traditions. I consider myself quite a modern person. I think modernity is, it's in the mind, it's being open to everything, being open to the world, being open to new ideas. And I think that Judaism and the study of the Torah, it opens the mind, it doesn't close it. Judaism and learning Torah, it's all about questioning. It's all about not taking anything for granted. It's all about, you know, analysis. It's all about skepticism. Don't believe everything. Find the sources. Where does it come from? What does it mean? That's what Talmudic study is. Now, there's certain things that we know are true, certain things that we've received from, that we know them because we've received them from our rabbis, from our parents, and we know that these things are true. These are part of us, as we spoke with our national memory, certain things we got with the Mesorah. Mesorah means the tradition, the chain of transmission. Those things we know are true. So the things that we know are true are not questioned. But anything beyond that, the interpretation of the Mesorah, the application of the Mesorah, its relationship to the outside world, all these things are totally open to question. Everything. And that's what we do. You learn a Gemara, you learn a Tosfos. You say, what does this mean? What does that mean? How does this fit with that? You know, and if you don't do that, you're not doing your job. If you just sit there and learn it and say, okay, you just translate the words and you absorb it, you memorize it, you haven't done anything. That's not what Talmudic scholarship is. So I think that type of approach to knowledge and to the world is, I think, extremely modern and extremely enlightened. And I consider myself, you know, in that sense, a modern person. What's the difference how I dress? What's the matter?
A lot of Orthodox Jews don't allow a television in their homes, and I wondered why.
I don't have a TV. And I wouldn't want to have a TV in my home because I think that, you know, a lot of the stuff on TV is not appropriate, first of all. And second of all, because it's a tremendous waster of time. People will, you know, I would rather my children, even if they're watching something that's good, but instead of sitting there and just looking and letting the TV take over their minds, it's true that they may learn certain things on certain, but I think I'd let them play games, let them read books, let them relate to other people, let them play sports, let them do something real. I think that, I don't remember know what the exact figures are, but I heard that the average American watches 5 to 6 hours a day of television. I think that's incredible. So where do they live? I mean, is that when you're sitting in front of the TV and just watching what's going on? I think I read somewhere that they measure the brain waves of people that are watching television, and it's similar to the brain waves of sleeping people. So basically, it is not an intellectual activity. It's not a creative activity. It's not something, you know, it's just the abdication of life and living vicariously through some kind of fantasy that appears in television. And I think it's the abdication of life. What's with your own life? You're busy watching all these lives. Well, how about living your own life? So I think it's a tremendous waste. And it's not something that my community, you know, approves of. But you know, I don't think that you go straight to hell if you open a TV when you're in a hotel, and I think many people do. Certainly, I like to watch you know, CNN when I'm in doctor's offices, you know, because that's something really that I do like to see, you know, actually see what's going on, not just read about it and not just see photographs. And you know, I don't, you know, but as being part of my life, I don't think it should be part of my life.
All right, that's it. Hot as hell, Jay.
Okay, that wraps up part number 3 of 4 with Rabbi Reinman. Be sure to subscribe so you'll get notified next time we upload a new installment of the Why Judaism audio files. And our new sponsor, Hazaka.com. These are Jewish games that feed the brain. Are you looking to play a game on Shabbos or Yom Tov with the older kids, let's say 8, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-olds? You don't have many options in the Jewish game department, but Hazaka.com is there to answer your need. There's Chametz, the game of Jewish Clue, and Yiddish Cup, the thinking person's game. Head on over to Hazaka.com. That's HAZAKAH.com. Thanks for listening.